2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was three blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com, follow us on Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.
If money affects your life in any way, Money Making Sense will talk about it. Be financially healthy, wealthy, and wise. Here's your host, Heather Kelly.
Welcome to Money Making Sense, the show that talks about all things money. Today, we're continuing our conversation with journalist and author Ivor Davis. He wrote a book, The Beatles and Me on Tour. And the first episode of our conversation, we went through the early years of the Beatles' finances. And now we're going to pick up right after their manager has died. Brian Epstein, I think he passed away in 1967. Is that correct?
Yes, he did. I mean, people said that he killed himself. I think that he was so into drugs that Brian was going to drug rehab, treated like a luxury hotel after 3 days he left. So he was bored. So, yes, he took an overdose, whether it was accidental, I don't think it was suicidal. But once he died, the Beatles kind of collapsed because Brian was their mentor. He was their headmaster. He would reprimand them. He was an image maker. And whenever they had disputes, whether it was financial or otherwise, they went to Brian, and he was the husband. And he's the guy who said, yes, no, forget it. When he went, the Beatles kind of, they exploded a bit, and all these things happened. And many of Beatle fans know they went their separate ways. And as I said earlier in the conversation, John Hyde, a kind of a rather alligator of a manager, and he had one camp, and Paul had his family Eastman camp, and they started butting heads. But that's what happened. And fortunately today, as I say, they have Apple, a gigantic operation that manages their money. And if you step out of the line with a Beatles song lyric or something like that, they will be on you.
Right. How long after Brian Epstein passed away were they able to form Apple, or were they already in the process of forming Apple when that happened?
No, I think what they did was probably about a couple of years after Brian died, they formed Apple. And Apple kind of was the financial umbrella that made things happen, that kind of gathered under the same fiscal umbrella. And Apple is still a formidable force, because I know the guy, Neil Aspinall, their road manager, in the early days became boss of Apple, because the Beatles were very loyal people who stayed with them for years. And Neil became the head executive officer of Apple. And he was the one that put together a terrific thing called the Beatles Anthology, which came out 30 years ago, kind of history, official history of the Beatles. So Apple was the umbrella that they run the show. I mean, I know that because I'm friends with a road manager of the Rolling Stones, and he told me that the Rolling Stones have a very tight organization. So Apple has a hierarchy. Whenever they do anything that's important, for example, when the Beatles decided to put on a show with Cirque du Soleil in Las Vegas, it was a sensational show, Beatle music, original Beatle music, and the acrobats that served the Soleil, they had to get the blessings of Yoko and Paul and Ringo and George's wife, before they could even go an inch, and they did. And so Admiral runs the ship with a very tired captain.
Yeah, and I've seen that Cirque du Soleil show, Love. Called Love. Oh, it's wonderful. And anybody who is a fan of Beatles music will just be in awe, let alone just watching the acrobats.
Heather, may I ask you a question?
Sure.
Okay. You've seen the Love show. I've seen it four times. Okay. I go and see it myself. I take my grandkids. I don't understand why that magnificent show doesn't have a company in Japan, in London, in anywhere around the world, Australia. I mean, can you imagine that it would be sell out in these countries? Cirque du Soleil Love only in the States. What's your financial picture?
I am wondering if, because you said Apple has such an iron hand on things, that maybe they're not allowing it to go anywhere else. Or maybe it had something to do with the contract they signed at Caesar's Palace. I think that it's at Caesar's Palace, right? Where it's being...
No, it's not Caesar's Palace. It's one of those hotels on the Strip.
Right.
That's true. The other thing is, I thought about this because when I went go, it's always sold out. When you walk out, Heather, you walk straight into the Tiffany shop, don't you?
Yes. Yep.
You can't get away. You can't. Don't you? Anyway, so I think maybe the Cirque du Soleil is so original. And they need to build the special auditorium showroom for the Cirque du Soleil, probably to be expensive. So the only place in the world you can see that show is where you saw it and where I saw it in Las Vegas.
Right. So I think I know what the very young John would have thought about all of this, the Cirque du Soleil and all the merchandise after it. But what about the John of the late 1970s? What would he have thought about this?
I think he would have changed a bit because he's interested. As you know, in the month of October, John would have turned 80. And I think he would have been the irascible John that I knew. He would have been the older man, cheeky John. He would be the guy that, when I said my name was Ivor, said Ivan, and I said, no, it's Ivan. And he said, Ivan, you're terrible. I said, okay, whatever you like, John. John was a provocateur. He liked to needle you. He liked to get a rise out of you. He had a brilliant sense of humor. He had a lightning fast mind like that. You remember Robin Williams in media?
Yeah.
Well, I think Robin Williams and John Lennon would switch to Burn. I mean, they could have been twins. Anyway, John would have said, okay, Yoko is no dummy, of course. She would have said, John, if you give your blessing to the Cirque du Soleil, there will be another 100,000, 200,000 checks being put into your bank, so why don't you go? John would have said, okay, there you go.
Wow, okay. I know that Ringo Starr and George Harrison formed a band in the late 80s, early 90s, Traveling Somethings?
Willoughbys or Willoughbys or something.
Traveling
like
Willoughbys. Was that... Right. Were they already making a lot more money? They were getting proceeds from Apple, or did they need to go on tour to make money at that point?
I don't think they needed to go on tour, but you've got to realize, look, Paul McCartney is, 79, 78. Ringo in July turned 80. They're all right financially, believe me, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, when you work like more than $1.3 billion, you don't have to borrow money from your family. And Ringo has a bit of work, just a mere $400 million. So the answer is that they are musicians, they are performers, and they get the big kick out of getting on stage. I went to see Paul 9 months ago. Well, actually, late 2019. He does a 3-hour, 15-minute show, a spectacular show. He's on stage, as I say, over 3 hours. When the Beatles performed, when I traveled with them, I'm going to ask you this question, so you can guess. 1964, Heather, how long do you think the Beatles performed on stage? Take a guess.
Oh, about 37 minutes.
Well, you're very close. Under 30 minutes.
I heard it's because the fans were screaming so loudly they could not hear themselves sing. But if there's so much noise around you, it actually blocks out your own voice and the guitars. They were playing so fast and singing so fast that they went through all their songs in that 30 minutes.
You're absolutely right. And when I was sitting in the front row every time, my feet in the front row every concert, the moment they came on stage, I couldn't hear what they were singing. I mean, this is a slight exaggeration, but for about 4 weeks, I wondered whether they were thinking, I want to hold for what? I wasn't sure whether it was your ankle, your kneecap, and it turned out to be your hand. And as you said so rightly, Ringo lost his weight several times, but that became a good lip reader. And it was ridiculous because the moment they stepped on stage, the audience, mostly young women, screamed and stopped. And at the end of the tour, John said to me, we were terrific, but we like performing dreams, that people come not to hear our music, they come to see us. And he didn't like that. So everything he said is spot on. They performed because they wanted to get off stage quickly. They ran through their songs without any dialogue. Once they finished singing Long Tall Sally, they put their guitars down. They were in the limo or the armored car or the meat truck or the ambulance that made a quick getaway out of the stadium. So it was in and out in a flash. Thank you, man.
Did you see Paul McCartney when he was on tour with Wings?
No, I didn't. But, you know, the interesting thing is I'm familiar with it because I'm friendly with a guy called Lawrence Cuba. And Lawrence Cuba is a brilliant guitarist who traveled for and Linda on Wings. And the interesting thing is that you've got to realize that when Paul finished the Beatles, he formed Wings. And when he started, he started in a bus, traveling to university towns, rinky-dinky places, playing. And then, of course, Wings got bigger. So Paul was the most shrewd of the Beatles. Paul had the counsel, financial counseling of his father-in-law and his brother-in-law, Linda Eastman's family. And Paul ended up buying back Beatles songs, buying old music because Paul's father, Jim, was a musician. And Paul, the reason he's the richest guy of the Beatles is that he truly realized that the songbooks of the Beatles and the songbooks of like Buddy Holly like that, we're going to be bad for. So support them. And it's a long-winded answer, but that's the truth, and that's why Paul is so mystery comfortable.
Wow. I had not thought of that. Makes my brain go in five different directions all at the same time. Is there anything else about the Beatles or their life after the Beatles that we should know about in a monetary way?
Well, not really, but at the beginning of the conversation, and it's not quite fiscal, but I'm going to throw it at you. Heather, you're a journalist, and people said to me, after the Beatles tour, this incredible story that 50 odd years later I still talk about, what did you do? Did you go home, sit down, and say, wow, I've just gone through an experience of a lifetime? And I say, no, I didn't. I said, I was a reporter. And what reporters do is they go home after a big story. And the next morning, the editor calls him and says, Ivor, I want you to go to New Orleans or Dallas or wherever because they just issued the Warren Commission report on the assassination of John Kennedy. And the next day, you've forget about the people and concentrate on your next story. Now, Heather, did that ever happen to you?
All the time. In fact, I have one story that I did recently. A family started baking cookies and taking it around to all the police departments in the state of Utah. And at first, they were doing it to a few different cities. So I covered them and did stories. And I said, hey, if you do wind up going across the entire state, let me know. Send me pictures. I can update the story. Well, I forgot all about it. And I get this text one day and telling me about, and we went to all these police stations and I had no idea who they were.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I did. I eventually figured it out, but it took me a good 15 minutes here to understand, why am I getting this text message? What are they talking about? And I had to connect the dots because, A, it had been about 4 or 5 weeks, and we'd had earthquakes, and we had COVID, and we've had elections, and the fires across the state, and murders, and then all of a sudden I get this text about some cookies, and I'm like, I don't understand.
What the heck is this, you said?
Right.
Well, that's exactly right, Heather, because you don't have the luxury of wallowing in yesterday's story, because now you have to focus on today. And when you do different stories the way you do, the way I did, you forget about it. And it's crazy, but a lot of people say to me, well, surely you realize that the Beatles was the biggest story that you, one of the biggest stories you've ever covered. I said, well, yes and no, but years later I covered the Bobby Kennedy assassination. I traveled with him when he got shot. I was in the kitchen. And then I went on to Ronald Reagan for president. And then so many stories don't have the luxury, as I say, wallow in what was yesterday. Yesterday all my problems far away.
That's just it. When somebody asks you, like you said a few weeks later, oh my god, that was the Beatles, but you still don't have any historical context. Even while you're in the middle of it, there is no historical context, and you have no idea that that is the biggest story that you've ever covered.
And the other thing is, I never knew that 50-odd years later you and I would be talking about. So I got like 10 autograph photos every time somebody said, hey, Ivor, can you get me a picture signed? I said, sure. And I got an autograph, and I ended up giving every single one away. And then I always said, today I think, my God, if I kept even half of them, originally signed pictures by the people, I would have been a rich man, and I could have retired Salt Lake City in luxury, right?
Right. Well, speaking of, have you been in contact with them over the last decade at all?
Not as a personal friend, but when I saw Paul at Petco Stadium in San Diego 9 months ago, I went backstage and had a terrific conversation. And I must tell you one story that Paul told me. I said to Paul, when I first, and Paul is charming, I must say, you see what you see is what you get. He's exactly the same as he was back in 64, except he's worth $1.3 million. Paul, but I said to him, you know, Paul, travel around the world, and when I know you back then, travel around in a beat up old car with no back on the gigs. I said, you know, how do you travel now? And I said, you had Neil and Mal as road managers, part of the staff. You know, what's it like today? Do you have more than 2 people? And how do you travel? He said, well, just came back from South America. Said, and we travel in our own jumbo jet. Oh, that's slightly different. And what about staff? Well, at last count, we have about 94 permanent staff members. So there's a slight difference there, ever.
And all the security, is that what he's considering part of the staff is the security, or is that separate?
problem. I mean, security is a whole different definition, but it's hard to imagine that when we traveled, when I traveled in the 1960s, they didn't have any security. They just had the two road managers. And when we got to a hotel, the hotel would sometimes put one security guy on the elevator, so that people got on the elevator and trying to get off the people's floor, they would say, you know, who are you here to stay, or where, show me your room. Security was lax. And the great thing for me was, of course, they didn't have any security, and I, whenever I passed, as I said, wander in, see them writing music, raise the mini bar much deeper with Brian Epstein, and it was kind of really, how are you doing, Ivor? That was great for doing this. And I could go in and talk to them without setting straight to the work. Things have slightly changed then.
Yeah. You just mentioned something that I would love to know about. It's not really money related directly, but you just said that when you wandered in and out of the room, you actually saw them writing music sometimes. How was that collaboration? Was it in the early days? Was it only John and Paul doing it, or did the other two try to chip in as well?
The only thing I saw on the whole trip was John and Paul working. And when I walked into the suite, they were on the floor with a kind of legal pad writing the music, and I knew they were busy. And when I on the plane, I'd say, what are you doing? What song are you doing? And they said that when we get back to England, we have a Christmas album, and this is September. We have a Christmas album with 16 new songs or so. So they were under tremendous pressure to write music because they wrote other people. I often got my 350 songs they wrote. And they had a deadline. Even when they were touring, they did two shows very often in cities. I don't think I can remember. We never came to Utah to perform in 64. I can tell that for sure. But the Beatles had a deadline. They were doing two performances a day. They were sometimes not staying in hotels overnight. And they had to turn out churn out songs, and they did. And of course, as everybody knows, the Beatles knows that in 64, their music was what I would call lollipop music. I want to hold your hand, love you, yeah.
Right.
Once they got in the hands of George Martin, the record producer, the legendary record producer, they started writing better songs, and George brought in guitars and cellos and violins, and their music became so much more sophisticated as time went on. And of course, they brought out some great albums after they stopped touring. And their last tour, their last public appearance in front of a paid audience was in the summer of 66 in San Francisco's Candlestick Park. And after that, you never saw the Beatles perform publicly on this path.
Right. But that 66, that was the same tour where they were practically run out of the Philippines, correct?
They were run out of the Philippines, and that was when the rot set in. They had supposedly upset Mrs. Marcos, the president's wife, by not showing up at a party for lunch that they get that she sent up to them. And so they had to get out of the Philippines fast, carry their own bag to the beach. And that sent them on the way to after the Philippines, of course, they went to America again. And if you remember, in 66, the tour was not as successful. John had made a pronouncement to a man magazine saying he was more popular. Jesus, or the Beatles were more popular than Jesus, that did not sit well with certain elements in the United States. So in 1966, fans were, or non-fans, were burning their records. John was worried that Mike Bennett was very dead.
Oh, yeah.
Scared.
How much money
And so that 66 tour was really not disastrous, but very, very sour. John tried to walk it back, but it didn't help. And that was the end of the Beatles on tour.
Right. And how much, do you know how much money they lost or maybe didn't make by the time they got to the U.S.? That's 1966 tour?
Well, in 1966, the crowd wasn't sold out. But don't forget, by then, Brian had realized that if you wanted to put on a tour promoter ever in Salt Lake City, and you wanted to put on a show, you had to come up with money up front. Probably by then was maybe $100,000. So whatever the situation was, if you were going to play in the Salt Lake City Auditorium, if there is a Salt Lake City Auditorium, I'm not sure, and you would have given Brian Epstein and the Beatle organization $100,000 guaranteed. So even though the leads were not all sold, and the promoters probably lost money, Beatles didn't suffer financially by that. Because okay. By then, of course, you had to pay to have the Beatles on your premises.
Right. So it was the promoters who were none too happy.
No, the promoters were very unhappy because of the bad press. I remember in Chicago, John trying to pull his way out. And I should have said, the Beatles are as popular as television rather than these.
Right.
So John tried to walk it back, but too late. He cut it out the bag, so to speak, and it reflected on their 66. And by then, as you said, as you cleverly and shrewdly pointed out, in the Philippines, it was a disaster. And they had to run to the airport, get out. And that soured them on touring, and as I say, after that, America again. And after America, again.
Wow. Okay. Well, Ivor Davis, you are a journalist and author, and I seriously could talk to you for 4 or 5 more hours. But you are the author of The Beatles and Me on Tour. So if people want to hear more about your experiences with the Beatles, what it was like to be with them, and it won't all be about money in that book, they can definitely go find that. Is that on Amazon right now?
Yes, it's on Amazon, or you can go to my website, www.ivordavisbooks.com, and you can not only see my book, Beatles and Me on Tour, and if I may mention it, I've done an amusing children's book for ladies and gentlemen, the penguins, and it's for children, and it's about 4 penguins on the British island of Auckland who learn to play music, and they want to be musicians as big as the Beatles. And just I'll add one line, done with a sense of humor, it's written for my grandchildren, and the Beatles, the Penguins are successful. They go to New York and they become the top attraction on a terrific variety show. And the name of the host of the show in New York is called Ed Pelican.
Ed Pelican. Nice. All right. I love that. And I know what that reference is without any of the other back stuff. When you say, ladies and gentlemen, the penguins, I think that is awesome. Oh, I love that. But you've also very quickly, you have written a couple of other books and you delve deeply into Charles Manson and the murders that his group.
Yes, I
did.
Have. I've written a book called Manson Exposed, the Reporter's 50-Year Journey into Madness and Murder. And the reason I wrote it was the new reason. Number one, I was there the first day of the murder. Number two, I covered the trial of Manson. And number three, many of your listeners may not know this, but the motive for the murders, according to the district attorney, was that Manson brainwashed his followers, and can you believe this, to believe that the lyrics from the Beatles' White Album was a message to Manson and his gang that bloodshed and revolution was in the air. And that triggered the murder. It was ridiculous when I heard it. I still think it's ridiculous. But Manson and his crazy followers were convicted, and the Beatles were very upset that the Beatles were dragged into this awful, awful murder, one of the worst of the 20th century.
I know that we should read the book to get that whole story, but are you saying that that was the DA's position?
When I covered the trial and realized Manson was the chief architect of these horrible murders, Sharon Tate, the pregnant actress, several others, I went to the Spahn Movie Ranch where Manson and his gang lived, and I spoke to members of the Manson family who had not been involved in the murders, and they told me an amazing story, which I just mentioned to you. They said that Manson said, in the lyrics of the Beatles' White Album, the Beatles were sending him secret messages warning him of this race riot. And the Beatles, of course, that was ridiculous, but the members of the Manson family believed it because he brainwashed them and gave them drugs. And that was the motive that the district attorney used. So when I was in court and listening to the opening statement by the district attorney, and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, the jury, this is why Manson sent his killers out, murder everybody. The Beatles made him do it."
Oh, my God.
I thought,
God.
Yes, I thought to myself, this is the most insane motive for murder that I've ever seen or heard. But, of course, I knew the story. And as I mentioned, and as the world knows, using that motive of Beatles music, the district attorney and deputy district attorney, Vincent Bugliosi, persuaded the jury to convict Manson and his gang on the Beatle music lyrics. So it's a weird story, and it really happened.
But also, do you think the DA was trying to get extra press? Because the second at that time, I mean, even now, even today, you mentioned the Beatles and all the cameras turn. So was the DA then just trying to get extra press coverage from this?
Well, no. Here's what happened. I mean, I don't want to get too long, but when I went to see Manson Acolyte in 1969, I wrote a very fast book, Time to Die, in which I outlined what I've just told you. Beatles lyrics, White Album, it's an incitement to kill. This is what the Manson gang told me.
Right.
And then the district attorney saw my book, and I mean, it sounds like I'm blowing my own strange trumpet, but he saw my book, and he used that thesis for the basis of his trial. But you've got to realize that because Manson's not actually at the murder scene of the actress Sharon Tate, he had to prove conspiracy in California. And so that Beatles lyrics sort of thought would reinforce the conspiracy element of the trial. And he used it, and as I said, he used it so successfully that the jury convicted everyone. So it's a weird story, and I don't know, next time maybe we can talk about the fiscal fallout from all that stuff and all the movies that were made. And I was recently on a 6-hour documentary about the Manson murder. So even today, people are hearing and reading about Manson. And it happened, of course, 51 years ago. That's another story, maybe, Heather, for another time.
Okay. So yes, we have plenty to talk about. All right. Again, Ivor Davis, you are a journalist and author. And you've written several books on different topics, and you've also covered some of the world's biggest happenings. And the one we've mostly discussed today is the Beatles and their finances. Thank you again, Ivor Davis, for joining me.
It's been a pleasure, Heather. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. You can email me with any questions or topics you want to hear about at hkelly@ksl.com. That's H-K-E-L-L-Y at ksl.com. And because this is Money Making Sense, you can subscribe for free on Spotify, Overcast, Apple Podcasts, anywhere you listen to your favorite podcast, and you'll never miss another episode.
Thanks for being a Money Making Sense listener. Follow your common sense on the social media, Money Making Sense, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
a stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.